This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
About 40% of the population either has no health care or literally they're uninsured because their health care is so expensive. Now, that is after all the subsidies.
Was the recent political fight in Congress over health care really a pillow fight? Ed Greistar of National Campaign for Single Payer explains.
And it's important to realize that this lawsuit was entirely initiated by UC, University of California faculty, not by the university itself. The university itself has done extremely little.
The American Association of University Professors takes the Trump administration to court over funding cuts.
We have to oppose the use of the Puerto Rican territory and American colony for belligerent purposes. We have to raise the call of U.S. out of Puerto Rico, close the military bases, and we should oppose also intervention of Venezuela.
Puerto Ricans reject the use of the island as a staging ground for a U.S. invasion of Venezuela. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The recent political fight in Congress over health care was really a pillow fight, said Ed Greistar, who is on the steering committee of the National Campaign for Single Payer. He's the former leader of the Butler County Central Labor Council in Pennsylvania, and he called out both Democrats and Republicans for the so-called debate about health care. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
To make things clear, both the Democrats and the Republicans favor and support the private insurers as the delivery mechanism for health care. And this whole fight is more like a pillow fight. It's a faux issue that one side wants to essentially keep the insurers subsidized and make any benefits based on taxpayer subsidies. Literally, we're talking about the last two or three years, it was around $60 billion in taxpayer money. And over the time of Obamacare, they have been subsidized billions and billions of dollars. They made more than almost $500 billion in profits. And while all that is going on, so they've been subsidized, they're making profits. And literally, there's a report from the Commonwealth Fund last year that said approximately 25 or 30% of the American people still don't have health care, even with all these subsidies and Obamacare. And then if you add the number of people who have what we call junk health care is just it's a pejorative term, but it really has objective meaning. When I say high deductible plans, all kind of restrictive networks, you end up with about 40% of the population either has no health care or literally they're uninsured because their health care is so expensive. Now, that is after all the subsidies. Now, on the other side, you have the Republicans, as you say, they're big about the insurance companies. But of course, what's behind their complaint is really to give the insurers complete freedom in the sense that they can establish worse healthcare plans. And what you see this is many right wingers on the internet and even met the doctors who are totally subservient to the insurers are saying, we don't need insurance anymore. We just need catastrophic insurance. And they have all these mechanisms where they think that people can pay out of pocket, which of course is absurd. So what it is you have the subsidization of a criminal entity by the Democrats and saying and defining that as progress. And on the other hand, you have demagogic Republicans complaining that the insurers are ripping us off, which they are, but their goal is to just make sure that the insurers provide even less benefits and then relabel that as healthcare. And that's really the choices that are going to unfold here. It's a losing perspective for working people. And so the conversation must change. And that's really kind of like where we're at. But of course, nobody is really talking about that, which is a real educational moment right now. It's like, if we don't interject our view into this, and I think the public is just perplexed, they're confused. You know, the Democrats said, we're going to save your health care, but their saving is just throwing more money to private insurers. That's not saving anything. That, you know, that's just, and we could have single payer national health care without any insurers. And the Republicans don't want any health care. They just literally want to have the insurance company say, well, we'll give you this low budget plan, and then you're on your own under the guise of freedom. So it's a dangerous. And what's really bad is that the public is supportive of what we're talking about, is Medicare for all, a single payer system that eliminates insurers. And people say, well, why would you want to eliminate insurers? Well, I think the catch here is that if you go back in history, the reason Medicare was established in the first place was because insurers wouldn't provide benefits to senior citizens. And there's just tremendous waste and criminality in the whole insurance scheme system. As most everybody knows, I think the catch is we don't really have to talk. You have to have facts, of course, and evidence, which is mountains of it. But most people are ready for a change. I think what we don't have is we have a political disconnect. There's totally a political disconnect, because who in Congress now is raising some of these issues at a time when they really should be raising them and say, let's change the terms of the debate. Let's renegotiate how we're going to do health care. They're not saying anything.
And the issue of privatization, Medicare Advantage, and which RFK Jr. actually said he supported Medicare Advantage. But isn't it true that the unions and the AFL-CIO have actually bought in to privatization of Medicare? In fact, they're advertising Medicare Advantage for union members to sign up to Medicare Advantage.
Yes. And again, that's another sad story. And the fact that, you know, as I said before, Medicare was established with the support of unions because private insurers didn't provide health care. They never stopped. They, meaning the insurers, never stopped. And because we have an AFL-CIO top leadership that is essentially rudderless, they have no vision, they have no fight, they have no capability of doing much of anything in the public interest. So they're easily swayed, unfortunately, by the propaganda of insurance companies, and they have literally bought into it. So rather than use their power and their educational tools to push a broad movement for real health care, as you say, they've bought into this. And it goes into the deep, deep crisis that faces American labor. And again, if we don't begin to have some type of rank and file educational or alternative vision, jokingly around, you know, I got my career started in the steel mills in Western Pennsylvania when we ousted a company union from the steel mill in Butler, Pennsylvania. And today, I say, we don't need company unions today, because most of them are just appendages of the corporations. It's like, and you can laugh about it, but it's very serious. And it's like, again, on the healthcare issue, we need to have a sharp analysis that is there. And the same thing with the labor unions. There's no way that the labor unions are going to change their opinion until there's threats and new leadership and a new direction. And that just takes a change of ideology. You can't be friends with corporations. You have to be a foe with them. And what we have is just the opposite.
That was Ed Greistar, a leader of the National Campaign for Single Payer, who talked about the pillow fight in Congress about healthcare, with both parties continuing to support private capitalist control of our healthcare system. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Just
PJ Morton and Yola, give the people what they want. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. A broad coalition of University of California faculty, staff, students, and unions sued to block the Trump administration's threat to cut federal funding to the University of California unless it adopted policies that critics say violated First Amendment rights. On September 16th, the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, filed suit, and last week, a U.S. district court issued a preliminary injunction stopping the administration from imposing fines or withholding grants. Michael Che is a professor of political science at UCLA. He's played a leading role in organizing University of California faculty against the Trump administration's attacks on the UC system, including funding cuts. He spoke to KPFK's Peter Ross in October.
So it's pretty clear that right from the start, you know, they went after Columbia and Harvard and, you know, University of California. They hit UCLA with this kind of absolutely nuts demand, like a $1.2 billion fine. So we got the largest fine, whatever. And then they went to this compact thing. And now very recently, a lot of the schools are rejecting the compact. So it's part of a very strong, well, an attempt to kind of take over the entire sector of higher education in the United States. And a lot of reasons for that. I think for me, the biggest one is, you know, typically in a lot of countries have seen that when a country becomes a dictatorship, the universities are one of the strongest ways people can push back. So, you know, my wife does work in South Korea. You know, students and universities have always been one of the strongest institutions and people to fight back against dictatorships and to bring democracy. So that's kind of the way I see it. That's really what's underlying what's going on. You know, there have been lots of cuts in the NIH and NSF and lots of other, you know, funding cuts. In particular, at UCLA, we got the Trump administration suspended grants, you know, to over like, I think maybe 500 million, 800 million, some very, very large number. So all of a sudden, all the people who have these grants on our campus, you know, couldn't fund their experiments. They had to let people go. They had to try to scramble for other funding. And it was very, very tough. I mean, people I've talked to, you said they were in the middle of like experiments about glioblastoma, you know, all these things which are affecting all of us. It can, you know, serious diseases. And they suddenly had to stop just in the middle of it. And sometimes, you know, stopping means like interrupting the experimental results that you wrote down for years. And so due to a lawsuit which UC Berkeley faculty had pursued, we were able to get these grants restored. And it's important to realize that this lawsuit was entirely initiated by UC, University of California faculty, not by the university itself. The university itself has done extremely little. So we sort of won that fight. You know, now we're fighting against this $1.2 billion fine thing, extortion attempt. And we have a lawsuit about that, saying that that itself is illegal, which is true. We don't know exactly what the Trump administration demand letter is because it was sent to UC administrations and they're not sharing it with us. And we're trying to get it from them. We've asked our UCLA Academic Senate to ask our administrators, and we voted like 116-0 to ask for that letter. Now we're doing a public records request. University of California is refusing that. So we're just a few days ago, a judge in California said that we do have the legal right to see that letter. Anyway, it's been reported in the news a little bit. It's the kind of the typical conservative Republican wish list saying like, oh, we can't, you know, acknowledge the existence of trans people, you know, have various kinds of overseeing. And like, I don't know, like there's one demand about like not allowing international students who have certain ideological views, basically imposing an ideological purity test on international students, stuff like that. So, you know, it's not serious. It's illegal. I mean, it's justified by using the Civil Rights Act, but we have like 170 UC law faculty who said that this is just illegal in itself. You know, when you use the Civil Rights Act, you have to do all these different procedures. There has to be a hearing, you know, statement of facts and all this. And so 170 UC law professors say, well, it's even when someone comes to an illegal request, it actually diminishes the rule of law for you to take it seriously. You know, you should just simply reject it. And it frustrates us to no end that the University of California administration seems to be taking it seriously, and even we worry that it might cave. It's just an extortion attempt, yeah.
That's strange that the UC administration wouldn't release the details of the demands.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some of the demands go directly to what U.S. faculty, have sole purview over, like admissions. Like, we have this thing in the University of California called shared governance, where the administration like has some purview over the budget, but things like who we hire, which graduate students to admit, all those things are completely within the purview of the faculty and our organizations, and which is the Academic Senate. So the fact they're not sharing with us is very, very strange and messed up. And it's also very strange and messed up that we have to sue our own university leaders to get this information. It's not, this $1 billion was $1.2 billion, I think, is just a threat. I mean, it hasn't been paid yet, but there is a lot of worry about possible funding restrictions. The Trump administration has said that grants from NSF and NIH will not be subject to political tests. Say that we want to do something on global warming, or vaccines or something really basic like that. Maybe the Trump administration is not going to fund those things. We're really worried about the possibility of grants being limited going forward. And of course, like you said, the University of California is the third largest employer of people in the state of California. So it's not just professors and students. It's like all our support people, people working in the hospitals, nurses. We have big members of the Teamsters here, so all sorts of support people, custodial staff, all the student support people. So, everyone is going to be affected if these grants are somehow diminished or restricted. So, we really have to stand together. And so this last lawsuit against this $1.2 billion fine thing, we were really, fortunate to get all these unions together. And UPTI, the Nurses Association, Teamsters, UAW, which is the union of graduate students, TAs, and many other unions as well, all participated. So we all need to fight back. And I think everyone also understands, labor understands that this is a moment which is important for our democracy. This is a threat to not just to our livelihoods, but to our very, democratic system. So that's why we did the lawsuit, yeah.
And could you talk more about how that coalition of labor unions came together and how they've been collaborating on this?
Well, I mean, I think the idea was started by CUCFA, which is the Council of University of California Faculty Associations. And so they said, let's, do what we should have done all along and just sue the Trump administration and get our day in court. And then the CUCFA, CUCFA leaders, reached out to all the different unions and just tried to get everyone on board, and everyone was really great. And so, so it was it's a little unusual because, we as faculty, we do our best to, to be in solidarity with all of our, AFSCME, UPTI, colleagues here at UC, but it's pretty, a strong step, and it's not, it's really kind of path-breaking, a watershed moment that we can all act together. So we really appreciate all the solidarity of all the different labor unions. Several faculty, some friends of mine, colleagues are on various, websites and stuff, and like with very scurrilous and false and stupid things said about them, on a completely separate issues. I've been in Breitbart twice, and once somebody put my home address in the comments and all that. And it's, it's just like, fear tactics. It's particularly, like you heard said, like it's really bad when our own employers give information, names and personally identifying information about, I think it was for all people who were complained about in the context of civil rights, complaints. So somebody could be complaining about you, and it could be anonymous. It could be just in process. It could have been just dismissed out of hand. You might not even know about it, but all that stuff was sent to the Trump administration. So it's very, very concerning and very awful. And the fact that, our own university did this, is just a huge breach of trust. I mean, the AAUP has, the American Association of University Professors has written about this, and they said, like at other universities, at least they took out the names. They put like respondent one or faculty member one or something, but the University of California, they just gave all the names. And we also don't know whether our names have been released. We give to Trump administration. But it's scary. It's very, it's very concerning. And it's, of course, just another way of trying to get people to be quiet and to intimidate people. This Trump administration is all about physical, intimidation, as we see on the streets. We have faculty and students who have been affected by ice. We had a patient who was taken by ice and was in having convulsions, and they took her to a UCLA emergency room. And then all the University of California, all UCLA policies about ice in our hospital just went out the window. You know, they were supposed to say, like, not allow ice into patient areas, but they went ahead and did it. And it was just pure, you know, folding. It was just, if people try to intimidate you illegally, you have to stand up to you. You can't just say, oh, sure, go ahead. You know, especially when you have all these other folks in the hospital who could be affected by ice being there. You know, so, you know, we're all just, you know, like everyone else here at Los Angeles now, you know, in Chicago and Portland and Washington, D.C., we just have to do what we can and to fight back and to, you know, support ourselves, support our community members. And that's what we're trying to do in all these different things. Like, we haven't had any issues as far as we know on campus, but of course, a lot of students are worried. I mean, back during the graduation ceremonies back in June, you know, there was an undocumented student ceremony. They canceled it, which probably is very reasonable, actually. But a lot of the student ceremonies were very worried. There's a Latinx celebration, a lavender celebration. They all asked for extra security from UCLA. UCLA said no. The head of security said, well, we don't want to poke the bear, i.e. the Trump administration. In other words, our head of security said that they cared more about how Trump administration would see us as than their own students. They could have easily, you know, helped us support our own students. So anyway, so as faculty members during these graduations, we just tried to help and take a, you know, look out for ice and escort people to their cars and that kind of thing. We have a lot of, you know, departments who they have to be, they're very concerned about parents going to their students, their graduates, some commencements just because of, you know, worrying about being tracked by ICE or whatever. So it's a big concern. And so now, you know, back in the fall, we're talking about all this stuff. We're giving, trying to help people understand their rights. We're going to make signs so people put them in the classroom saying it's a private space and ICE is not allowed here. You know, very basic stuff like that. Just trying to, you know, we have a lot of now restrictions. This is imposed by the university about protesting on campus. We're trying to push back on that. So all these things we're trying to do to make it, you know, protect our community. I mean, protect our students, protect our students' parents. You know, we have a large percentage of international students here. You know, a lot of them are not feeling super great about being in the United States. How can we support them? We're working on that too. So all these things. I was talking to one of my friends who works in the world of foundations, you know, like charitable foundations and philanthropy. And she was saying that very early on, all these foundations, including, you know, like So Much Conservative, joined together and they did this website called Unite in Advance, which is saying, don't mess with us. Don't, you know, we're not going to respond to any kind of threat to try to, you might make, the Trump administration might make to get us to give money only in certain areas or something. And my friend asked me, so why haven't universities done this? And it's exactly right. Like, even with this, you know, compact thing, you know, very, you know, it was great that so many universities are now speaking against it and not refusing it, like MIT, Brown, USC. But there should be a sector-wide response. So in my feeling, we really need to work on higher education, speaking with, you know, one voice, because we all have, you know, everyone's thinking like by themselves. And like, I mean, I was thinking like, telling my friend, like, if you're Columbia and this happens, it seems like the first thing you do is, if you're the president of Columbia, is call your friends at other universities and say, what are we going to do about this? But it seems like, no, everyone's thinking about themselves alone, which is really, really the wrong way to go about it. I mean, everyone's thinking about placating or something. So I think that we've finally turned a corner, that everyone's realizing this compact thing is just, you know, just a terrible thing. So, you know, more and more people will reject it. And I think, so now I think people are understanding that there's no good thing will come from trying to negotiate or make a deal. And so I think that we really need to build a sector-wide response. So I think as faculty through the AAUP, we're starting to do that, which is great. I really wish our university leaders would do the same thing and act as one, or just even just do a press conference saying me and my, you know, all the Ivy League presidents or all the, you know, the Big Ten presidents or, you know, whoever, just say, you know, we reject, you know, just to get together and say that we're acting as a group, as opposed to like just individually. So, you know, I feel like overall we're kind of succeeding. I think that people, you know, I think the Trump administration thought, oh, we're going to go after Columbia. And if you get them to fall, we'll go to, you know, Harvard, then maybe University of California, then other schools, and then maybe they'll do the compact. But, you know, at least University of California has not, you know, caved in yet. They, you know, we're worried they might at any moment, but every day we keep it from caving, I think is good. And so, you know, these lawsuits are really helping with that. You know, we succeeded and faculty succeeded in restoring the grant suspension. So that's definitely helping with some of the immediate kind of bargaining leverage from the Trump administration. So, you know, all these things are really helping. So I feel like we are turning a corner, and it really makes me feel like great that, you know, people are rejecting the compact. So that's very good. Yeah.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say that I've maybe missed asking about?
I don't know. I just feel like, you know, I'm a big KPFA, KPFK listener from way back, you know, and I feel like it's so important that we all have the right to express ourselves, think ourselves, and do research we want. And, you know, universities are definitely a part of that. And I feel like, you know, attack on universities is really an attack on freedom of thought. I mean, it's like if there's any one thing that you want to go after freedom of thought, you go after universities and the media, you know. And we have seen a lot of media organizations completely cave, you know. And I was beginning to worry that universities might cave, and still, I guess, maybe it's up in the air. But I think we're doing okay in pushing back. But I just hope that people aren't, and maybe we have to do more to reach out to people, but I hope people kind of see that by fighting back for our universities, it's not just about us. It's not just about our little thing. I think we really do see it as part of our responsibility to our democratic society, our responsibility to young people, to doing research, you know, to doing all the things which help humanity. And really, we see it as protecting freedom of speech, freedom of thought in our society as a whole. So it's not just about our little, you know, like whether we get to keep our jobs and all that. It's really a very, I think, a profound thing. And kind of like I said before, you know, all dictatorships go after universities. It's just, you know, you saw that in Turkey, with Turkey, Hungary, and all these places. And, you know, in South Korea, you definitely saw it. And I really appreciate everyone who's helping us in our struggle. And I feel like, you know, we're going to help everyone else as much as we can too. So please think about us. Please keep this in your minds. And please, you know, try to remember that we're here for, you know, young people. We're here for the future. We're here for our democratic system. We can see ourselves as a very important part of that. So, I mean, I think this linking up labor with labor, you know, actually a lot of our organization here at UCLA started, at least our faculty organization started with the 2022 UAW strike. This is a strike of basically graduate students who are TAs and RA research assistants. And they were sick and tired of being paid a very, very low amount of money. And so, you know, they were not 100% successful. For example, a lot of people, there was a big demand to, you know, help international students more. And that failed. But overall, you know, there was a very large win. They, you know, got larger salaries. And so without that struggle, I think our faculty group, we started kind of as like, basically trying to support them and trying to say, hey, you know, we want our TAs to get better paid. And that's kind of at least how I got to know a lot of folks around here. And we kind of built that. And that was kind of the way we organize our faculty association now. And, you know, so we owe that struggle, our kind of our formation to that struggle, even though it wasn't our struggle, we kind of support them, you know, so all these things come together, you know. And so like when we were working with all the other unions, AFSCME, UPTI, you know, the Teamsters, UAW, you know, this is just to me the beginning of all sorts of great things which can happen, you know. I keep on telling people, you know, the UAW strike, the TA strike here in California, and, you know, over 100,000 people were involved with this, and all these folks are now going to go into all these different jobs, the academia, the tech, you know, and going to bring, you know, union organizing to many parts of the knowledge economy, which, and so that's really a pretty profound thing, I think. And so I'm thinking that, you know, our faculty association was really small for a while, but we're growing very, very rapidly now. And, you know, what I've learned is that, like, when people, in a situation where people are really persecuted, that they're fearing for their safety, they're fearing for their rights, anything which can help them feel more secure, anything which gives them a sense of solidarity and protection is so important. It's very, very important. And I've understood now that unions are a big part of that. You know, they just simply are, you know. So, like, you know, we're not a union, or faculty, you say faculty association is not a union, maybe we'll be at some point, but just the very fact that we exist, even though it's not like some sort of huge, powerful thing, you know, it gives people a place where they can meet other people and talk and, you know, understand that they're not alone. And that is so, so important, so powerful. And you know, I'm really grateful to everyone who went to help organize it. And, you know, at this moment in the history of the United States, unions can be that in general, you know. So if you think about, you know, one thing which you often hear is like, if you're not sure what to do, join something, you know, just join your community organization, you know, join a neighborhood organization, whatever. But, you know, if you look at who has been pretty good at, you know, fighting back against dictatorships, you know, against all these crazy conservative policies, it's been unions. So why not join your union? That's pretty good. You know, just get involved, you know, and if you can build that strength, you should help us pull through this moment, and we'll probably have all sorts of great implications for the far future as well.
That was UCLA political scientist Michael Che speaking with KPFK's Peter Ross. Their conversation was recorded in October before the latest legal developments. Since then, a federal judge has issued a preliminary injunction blocking the Trump administration from enforcing its threatened funding cuts or conditioning grants on restrictions of UC workers' and students' First Amendment rights. That was Monophonics, Last One Standing. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. At a panel for the Labor Education Project on AFL-CIO International Operations, labor researcher Ricardo Ortiz reported on the U.S. military's use of Puerto Rico to prepare for the invasion of Venezuela. He said they were greatly expanding training, opening new bases, and even test firing a Trident missile over the island, terrifying the residents, and that the people of Puerto Rico were protesting.
Let's do and put some historical context. Actually, since the beginning of the United States as an imperialist power in the 19th century and early 20th century, you know, starting from the Monroe Doctrine all the way down, the United States showed an interest in establishing its influence and dominion in the Caribbean basin and throughout Latin America, and particularly in Venezuela. In 1908, the United States Navy helped Venezuelan President Juan Vicente Gomez to seize power in a coup. And Gomez, by the way, he immediately endeared himself to Washington Wall Street by granting highly lucrative concessions to foreign oil companies, including Standard Oil, which is a contemporary ExxonMobil. So, you know, right from the get-go of the emerging new imperialist power, the United States had its dirty hands in the Republic of Venezuela, intervening in their government and resources. We got to understand that during this very early period in the 20th century, the United States in 1915 invaded Haiti, invaded the Dominican Republic, 1917 invaded Mexico, all of this, 1934, Nicaragua, all with the intentions of establishing political hegemony and obviously the ability of dominating the Caribbean basin politically. I don't have to mention that also through the results of the Spanish-American War, which Vladimir Lenin called the first imperialist, inter-imperialist war, the U.S. obtained Cuba and Puerto Rico, the the Philippines are one in the Pacific. So we got to make these historical connections to start understanding the beginnings of Yankee imperialism intentions in the Caribbean basins. During the period of the decade of 1948 to 1958, the United States backed one of the ruthless dictatorships in the Americas. It was in Venezuela. And this was led by Marcos Perez Jimenez, whose regime forced political opposition to exiles, massacres, and he obviously was very generous to a transnational corporation, as well as he was cruel to his own people. The funny aspect of this is that after Perez Jimenez was thrown away, there came a series of reformists, beginning with Romulo Betancourt, which was the president of Venezuela in a couple of instances, through a party called Partido Acción Democrática, which is a social democratic party. And immediately, Betancourt linked relations with the U.S. He was supported by the U.S. and also, you know, have a very close links with the American CIA. With the president of Costa Rica at the time, José Figueres, called as Pepe Figueres, and the governor of Puerto Rico, Luis Muñoz Marín, they called themselves the Democratic Left in America, in Latin America, which supposedly was going to fight against right-wing dictators, but also against communism, you know. And all these three persons had links with American sinister intelligence agencies, you know, mainly the CIA. And this, there is plenty of information about this in documents declassified by the American government. Fast forward to the present, because we got to understand that this is not an accident. This is a consequence of an epoch. We're living an epoch of economic crisis, of American decline, American empire decline versus its competitors. And I just want to say that Venezuela is right now the country in Latin America that is threatened the most with imperialist military intervention. But it's not only Venezuela which the Americans are trying to reestablish or reassert hegemony. I'm going to read you a quote from January 20th, 2023. During a visit that General Laura Richardson, former commander of the United States Central Command, said while she visited Argentina. And actually, let me say a couple of things. She was the head of the U.S. Southern Command while President Biden was in office in the United States. And she said while she visited Argentina, and actually at that time, it was the government in Argentina being run by the Peronist coalition, led by Alberto Fernandez and his vice president at the time, Cristina Fernandez. She said, with all the resources and rare air elements, there is the lithium triangle, which is necessary for technology. 60% of the world's lithium is found in the lithium triangle made by Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile. And she also mentioned the largest oil reserves, including crude and gold, are found recently in Guyana. And she said that Venezuela is rich by oil, copper, and gold resources that are vital to the United States' national interest.
Why this region matters with all of its rich resources and rare earth elements. You've got the lithium triangle, which is needed for technology today. 60% of the world's lithium is in the lithium triangle, Argentina, Bolivia, Chile. You just have the largest oil reserves, light sweet crude discovered off of Guyana over a year ago. You have Venezuela's resources as well with oil. Copper, gold. We have the Amazon. We have the 31% of the world's fresh water in this region, too. I mean, it's just off the chart. And so I think we have a lot at stake, but we have a lot to do. This region matters. It has a lot to do with national security.
And then the very same imperialist commander, in a speech at the Center of Strategic and International Studies on August 4th, 2023, she mentioned, you know, that not only the U.S. had the interest of controlling, you know, these resources, she also mentioned the need of the United States to keep China off Latin America. So this is a big drive by the United States to reassert his hegemony over Latin America, that throughout the years he has been facing competition by the European Union, China, Canada. Right now has a lot of the most important mineral corporations, which are based in Canada. The Marxist academic Vichai Prashav made an excellent study showing that, you know, at this moment as we speak, Canadian-based mineral corporations are doing a big inroad in Latin America and throughout the world. And also, you know, there are companies like Repsol, which are based in Spain, that in some Latin American countries, they compete highly and strongly versus U.S. interests. So, you know, the U.S., obviously, it is the most powerful imperialist country in the world, and no empire is going to go down without attempting to put up a fight. And we have to oppose, definitely, U.S. intervention in Venezuela. There are a couple of aspects right here that must be mentioned. Puerto Rico, which is an American colony, since the beginning of the 20th century, 2 years after the American forces landed and colonized the island, began the colonization of the island, they began to construct military bases throughout the Puerto Rican territory. At one point, the 13% of the land in Puerto Rico was occupied by American bases, mostly naval bases. And throughout the years, people, through mass mobilizations, were kicking out these American bases, culminating with the victory that the people of Puerto Rico achieved through, you know, a protest, Navy occupied land occupations, and the solidarity that grew up all the way through the Americas and the world with the people that were fighting to get the Navy out of the firing ranges that were located in Vieques and the big naval complex in Roosevelt Roads Air Station, which actually all the Roosevelt Roads naval complex in territory was even bigger than the headquarters of the Atlantic Fleet, which is based in Norfolk. So what is happening right now as we speak? Since August, you know, of this year, the American armed forces quietly have been doing, and not so quietly, began doing exercises in this former Navy-occupied land. People in Puerto Rico were awakened, surprisingly, to find in a small town called Arroyo in the eastern part of the island, by a training of American Marines landing in this town that doesn't even have an airport, doesn't even have a port. And all of a sudden, these people in this little town are awakened by American Marines landing. And all of a sudden, it was revealed that in another part of the island, in Puerto Rico's National Guard base called Camp Santiago, United States Marines were training with Puerto Rican National Guard troops. And if that was not enough, in a Muñiz Air Base, which is an Air National Guard base in San Juan, which actually the U.S. was even thinking about closing that National Guard installation, 10 F-35 fighter bombers landed, you know, and people photographed it. And surprisingly, in the town of Guayama, I mean, Guayama is a little town like it would be Point Reyes right here in California. People saw you know, approaching the USS Iowa, troop carrier and a naval, you know, a huge vessel. And all of a sudden, if this is not enough, you know, people were frightened when they, a few weeks after all these maneuvers, something that looked like a missile went across the island. And, you know, the press went and asked the Pentagon and the Navy and, you know, the American government, what was happening? And, you know, the Navy confirmed that it was a test of a Trident missile that went across the island of Puerto Rico. But this has not happened without being opposed. Every Saturday in Puerto Rico, unfortunately, in the U.S., there's not much coverage of this. But people have been protesting by the Puerto Rican Independence Movement and other civil society organizations. The in each of these installations, and every time that they discover that the armed forces, the U.S. armed forces, are doing training, they are doing pickets organized by Madres Contra la Guerra, the Puerto Rican Left, you know, the Movimiento Socialista de los Trabajadores, Democracia Socialista, and other organizations. And we have to oppose the use of the Puerto Rican territory and American colony for belligerent purposes. We have to raise the call of U.S. out of Puerto Rico, close the military bases, and we should oppose also intervention of Venezuela.
That was Puerto Rican labor researcher Ricardo Ortiz reporting on U.S. military expansion in Puerto Rico in preparation for an attack on Venezuela. He said there is growing opposition to the use of Puerto Rico as a staging area.
Hijo del cañaveral, nunca se nos cae la pava. Esta raza siempre es brava, aunque sople el temporal. Pa' que sientas el calibre de un caballo sin jinete. Mira cómo corre libre, se refleja en el machete. Hijo del cañaveral, nunca se nos cae la pava. Esta raza siempre es brava, aunque sople el temporal. Pa' aprender a defendernos, nunca fuimos a la escuela. Aunque el toro tenga cuerno, nuestro gallo tiene espuela.
A latigazo limpio desde el descubrimiento, no pudieron, seguimos con el mismo acento. Nuestro aguante ha sido digno, somos los versos que no cantan en nuestro himno. Hay que soltar los barcos del muelle, esta carreta ya se mueve sin bueyes. Al colono lo bajaremos del trono pa' que nuestra bandera cante en un solo tono. En el 4, Luisito Sanz.
Residente, hijos del cañaveral. Frank Hammer is the retired president of United Auto Workers 909 Local at the General Motors plant in Detroit. His family, who had Jewish heritage, escaped from Nazi Germany, and he sees parallels between what is happening in Chicago and what happened to his grandmother. Frank Hammer spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
I think people, you know, grapple with the question of, you know, what is fascism? Is fascism? Is it correct to describe what's going on in the United States as fascism? And the way I can shed some light on that is from my own family experience, and that's a little bit of a story. So I'm going to go back to where my family came from. My family came from Germany. My family, my father and my mother, fled Germany when Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933. My dad saw the writing on the wall. He was the son of an industrialist. He was not, you know, in any way on the left or anything like that. But he had enough insight to know that things were going to get pretty dangerous. And to explain, even though his family had generations before converted from Judaism to Lutheranism, it didn't matter because all the families in Germany had to register with local authorities in regards to their family lineage. So my family's lineage, traced back in some other previous generation to Judaism, and therefore they would be in danger being picked up by the German police, the Gestapo. So they left. They left Germany, and they cautioned other family members to do the same because of the dangers they saw coming down the pike. And there were other family members that paid it no mind and disregarded that advice. And one of those particular family members was on my mother's side, her grandmother, who lived in Berlin. And the story about her, and the reason I want to bring her up, and if I may make a little intermission here, is that there was an incredible parallel between what I'm going to describe about my grandmother to what transpired in the city of Chicago. What was it, 3, maybe 4 weeks ago? This horrific scene was in the middle of the night, I think it was around 3 in the morning, where these Black Hawk helicopters hovered over this large apartment building. And these agents came down the ropes and came down on the rooftops of the buildings and then went through the buildings and crashed the door of every apartment. And there's a multi-floor units. And not only did they secure and drag the people out, and I know that there were descriptions in the media about people half naked and they were zip tied and all that horrifics of what transpired. And also you saw some images of what they left in terms of what was in the apartments. And it was totally disheveled, destroyed, everything was scattered. And it reminded me back to my experience and my mother's mother. The Gestapo came to her building where she lived, to her floor, and did exactly the same, dragged her out of her unit and destroyed everything in her apartment. And the way we learned about this, and this was transmitted to me, was that the concierge of that building had gone up to see what remained of the apartment and found only one plate intact. And took it. And I can tell you, this is the plate that came out of that apartment after the Nazis went in and destroyed it and grabbed her and took her out. And the parallel to witness what was done in Chicago, never mind that the White House made this glorified drama video of it, was chilling. And it just told me that that wasn't by coincidence. They're drawing from a playbook, and that playbook goes back to Nazi Germany. And we have to understand that. They have a playbook, and they're following a script, and that was one incident that just was too eerily the same as what my own family experienced. So I want to put that in the context of the people when they talk about what's going on in the U.S., have some parallels and understanding that this is quite like what the Nazis and what Hitler did in Germany in the lead up to the concentration camps and the extermination camps and so on.
That was retired UAW 909 Detroit GM President Frank Hammer talking about what happened to his grandmother in Germany under Hitler and what is happening today in Chicago with the ICE raids. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Peter Ross, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.